Silvo, the first time that I heard it live through the microphone and through my headphones, the way that it transmitted through the landscape and the reverberation of the mountain, that was amazing. That was quite a moment.
Hello, welcome to Wind is the Original Radio, a podcast where on Tuesdays we have conversations with the best nature listeners in the world. We talk about the work and philosophy of each artist, as well as learnings from nature they share with us from their own experience. On Fridays we publish long format immersive nature soundscapes for contemplation and to help you relax. I'm Melissa, I am hosting and creating this podcast for Earth FM. Today's guest is Rudiger Ortiz Alvarez, a trained biologist specialized in ecology from Spain, and is also a nature field recordist. Rudiger is a National Geographic explorer and will be talking about the Silvo, a whistle language he explores in his documentary Ecotone. Now, on to our conversation.
My name is Rudiger. I'm from Spain. I was trained as a biologist and I specialized in ecology. I actually started to work in microbial ecology, which is something super different to soundscape recording and aquacoustics, bioacoustics, all these things. But eventually I noticed that there were a lot of methodological similarities and I started to work with sound and I found it so fascinating that I had to enter into that field. So I earned a National Geographic grant, becoming a National Geographic explorer, and I started from there.
Could you expand about the aspect that you found similar in the methodology you talked about?
Well, this was very technical. When I was doing microbial ecology, I used to think like you have DNA, and you have to extract from that DNA the different species that are there and extract ecological patterns that are in the DNA. It's called metabarcoding. That's a different field. But while listening to sounds, I felt like I could use sound as my DNA in a way and start to extract the different types of sounds, start to draw different species and ecological patterns. That's what that ecoacoustics does. And I found that from statistics and technical things, there were similarities that I could start to work with. So I was not starting from zero, let's say. Many people that goes into aquacoustics and soundscape ecology, I mean, they come from different fields. And I think it's kind of novel. Let's say it has already been there for quite a few years. But it can take things from many different fields, even if they look very different at first.
Mm-hmm. The more I meet people that are more specifically into nature field recording, the clearer it is for me the fact that most of people are very multidisciplinary. Many of us tend to learn about animal behavior, geography, in some cases even anthropology and disciplines in social sciences. And many are also directly related to arts, either coming from it or developing into something artistic as well.
Yes. Before starting to work with sound, I was familiar with ecological theories and ecological succession, studying diversity, alpha, beta diversity, which is studying different components of how life is organized. And when I started to work with sound and with those theories in ground, it was mind-blowing for me. I mean, this is the science part. I also the more artistic part. But since I was explaining my background, I think this is where I come from.
Mm-hmm. And even with this background, did you have specific insights through the practice of listening and recording sounds?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what happened. I was by the end of my PhD thesis. This was 2017, and I was doing the PhD thesis on microbial ecology, as I said. And I was on holidays at the Borneo rainforest at dusk. I was with a colleague there trying to see flying squirrels. I was not expecting anything acoustic to happen, but as you know, rainforests, pristine ecosystems can be amazing. And suddenly the sound around me started to explode. it was like an orchestra of things. I was like in the middle of something that I was like, wow, what is happening here? And that was the moment for me, because obviously I pay attention to nature in other moments, but these places have such an amazing complexity and diversity of sounds that I was, okay, this is not random. There are a lot of things happening here, and I want to know what is happening here. So that's the moment where I actually connected, and I was like, okay, I need to start understand what are the dynamics of this sound. Who is the director of this orchestra? How is it working? I think that sound can provide a whole different level to the story and how do you connect to what you're trying to tell. That moment in Borneo, I think, is like I opened a door that I'm not able to close it. Like, I want to keep exploring, even if I'm working in different things. Like, I will continue doing field recording and connecting to different places and exploring it. In that moment, I wanted to feel more connected to nature, and I realized that the way to do it was through music. I have musical background from many years ago, and I never got to put that into the science that I was doing. And I wanted to do something a little bit more, I don't know, something that you can connect with. In that moment, through my science, but I wanted to feel more connected.
And how did your connection with nature and other living beings started? Was it early in your childhood or later on?
There is a particular soundscape that is embedded in our brains. And I think it's the place where you grow up. The sound that you listen while growing up is something that sticks in your brain, wired there. I was growing in a pine tree forest. It's like in San Lorenzo de Escorial. It's close to Madrid, but it's not in the city. And I was always connected there through sounds. And also I have to say my mother did a good job, because she was kind of a bug geek. So we were always checking on animals in the area, little frogs. She makes sure that I enjoy the outdoors. But also the sounds that I was listening while growing up there were very different to what people hear in the cities. So that thing is one of the things connected me through nature. I think that's something that happens with people that grows up in very dynamic cities, like with full of cars and traffic. I have, for example, a colleague who has been only in nature outdoors 5 times, and he's actually super disconnected to anything in nature through sound and through everything. And this is something that happens to a lot of people. So yeah, the connection with nature, I think, it seems like something could be simple, but it's more complex than it seems, I think. And an incredible amount of people is already disconnected and they don't even notice that difference. So yeah, for me, it's a little bit sad as well. And it's an issue that is important to target. That's one of the reasons why I did my documentary, right? Like, I wanted to show that we are in danger of being super disconnected and that our origins are actually there in nature.
Yeah, but speaking for myself and also as a person who indeed feels better in a natural setting, I really feel that it's easy to regulate my emotions being outside in nature rather than even inside my house or more obviously if I am in the city. But to feel, for me, this idea that really we are nature and that nature is us. You know, first of all, language. When we hear speak about nature, we, at least I always was, you know, thought to think about it as something completely separated from me. And to be very honest, you know, I still don't grasp truly like the idea that we are one with it. And I do feel more distance if I am in the city, for example, which I also enjoy a lot at times with cultural events and new foods, things to do, more people to see, you know, this kind of thing that is also part of being a social being.
Yeah, me too.
But I know that belonging to nature doesn't really reject this cultural urban side. And despite feeling that cities and urban areas sometimes are a little bit grotesque in the amount of concrete, light, pollution, sound, things to buy. But I would like to think that there is really a possible middle ground. And in that aspect, how do you imagine that cities could be in the future?
I'm not an expert on urbanism, but if I had to speak for myself, obviously cities can be more healthy to us than what they are now. For example, I'm picturing Madrid. Now they are cutting a lot of trees because of different reasons. Some reasons are more like, okay, we have to build a subway, so we need to cut these trees because they are like in the middle. And people is actually complaining, is demonstrating, but they are going to cut them anyway. So these kind of things are not actually going to help what we were discussing. In an idealized world, hopefully in the future, there will be less cars, more public transportation, more green areas. I'm not saying that we're going to have a full forest inside a city, but perhaps places that are not that fast. We live super fast. I mean, right now I live in the center of the city, and sometimes I feel like, wow, everything is madness. Sometimes I like it. I can go to a theater, I can meet friends, and I go to a bar. I mean, it's fantastic. But some other times it's like, okay, I need to go to my hometown and stop a little bit for a weekend. I don't know how cities must develop, but what I know is that slowing down, it's the place where I would like to go.
So you have studied the Silvo in La Gomera. So could you explain what Silvo is? And I wonder if you know of connections between this communication system and other places in the world that have a similar one?
Silvo is an endemic whistle language from the Canary Islands, particularly from the islands of La Gomera, and is used to communicate long distances. So instead of walking for hours, you can just whistle and you're talking through the landscape, and the message can be heard at up to 8 miles or 5 kilometers distance away. So it's like something very useful when you are outdoors and doing this, for example, with cows or cattle. You're a shepherd and you need to communicate with someone. Hey, have you lost a goat? You know, these kind of things. So the whistle languages, I mean, one of the places where it's more studied and is in the best health is in La Gomera, where this is where I've done some work and one of the targets of my documentary. But as you said, there are other places in the world where they have whistle languages. For example, the closest place to Canary Islands in the Moroccan mountains, they have also a whistle communication system, let's say, based on Tamasing, which is the language of the area. But what is the problem? The whistle is kind of stuck without any improvements. I mean, if you don't use it, you lose it from the culture, right? And there are very few speakers of Silvo in the Moroccan mountains. Another example that actually was lost is in the town of As in the Pyrenees, in the French part. They also had a whistling technique and they used it to communicate in Occitan. So the problem with that is that they lost it, okay? But there were records of it. So now they are teaching it in schools, but based on Silvo Romero. So it's like there are places where it's more like an anecdote right now. There are other places in the world where you can hear whistling, which is also in Turkey, in Greece, and in the Amazon. There are dozens of types. I don't know if they are related in any way. I haven't seen any studies checking if there are relationships between the places where there are whistle languages. But the thing in common is usually that they exist in places with mountains and where people use cattle and they have agricultural and shepherd techniques. So these are kind of the common ground. It's likely that depending on the type of environment that you have and the vegetation that you find, you can adapt a little bit the whistling. So you can be a little bit higher pitches, lower pitches, depending of what is the optimal transmission.
Do you think that bird vocalizations or even other species are a source of, let's say, inspiration for the, you know, either creation or evolution of languages such as Silvo?
In the specific case of Silvo, the origin is not fully known. So I was speaking to a researcher once about this, like, okay, it's possible that people got Silvo by inspiring them from birds to catching those frequencies, or maybe it's definitely possible. I like to think about this as an ecological convergence. I don't know what inspired the first person to whistle, but it's true that the frequencies that are used both by blackbirds and by people are good frequencies to transmit in the landscape of the island. So that's at least we are ecologically adapted there for speaking.
I'm also deducing that when people are more aware of the geography and some particularities of their own language, how can that also work to protect themselves from like military forces between Portugal and Spain, for example, during conflicts and civil wars? There was a lot of contraband between the borders, and for sure there were, you know, almost secret codes for people to warn each other about certain events or things like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was one of the people that I interviewed for the documentary, Manolo. He actually spent 1 hour speaking to us about his military service. I asked him about Silvo and he spoke about how they used it. Like, they could communicate in the whole island like, hey, the civil war is here. And in 20 minutes, the whole island knew that. So they could protect themselves using this language. So probably was very useful in this type of context. Also, another use that this language has, for example, imagine that someone passed away. So they adapted the Silvo to a more mourning type of whistling with longer cues and more slowed down sound. And as well, they could say, hey, the funeral is going to be at 4 p.m. in the church of blah, blah, blah. And in 20 minutes, the whole island knew. So there were different also situations that changed how they used it. So when they communicated these languages, they used a slower cadence and longer cues. The Silvo was like, choo-choo. So this, choo, they made it longer. And I don't know if there is a reason for that or just it was something embedded in the culture. But for me, it was interesting. It was like, you don't whistle the same way when you're saying, hey, you lost a goat or someone passed away.
Yeah, so it shows that emotion is also printed in this language and communication form.
Exactly. It's not code Morse. It's like a proper, it has emotion embedded in it.
In the context of nature recordings, where what we call like pure nature, and we don't include machinery sounds like cars, aeroplanes, in some cases also domestic animals like dogs. If you are, for example, in La Gomera and you are recording the dawn with blackbirds, and there would also be people using Silvo to communicate, would you consider this biophony, anthropophony, or what do you think about that in these terms?
Based on the classification of biophony, geophony, anthropophony, I mean, I have to put that in anthropophony, technically. But it's true that it doesn't sound like something that is like a different component. I mean, we are also biophony. We should be biophony, actually. There is also this separation. I don't know where I read this about, okay, you have anthropophony, but you have also the anthropophony coming from technologies and the one from just us walking or just talking. Perhaps I would separate it there. But if I'm asked to have a proper, beautiful soundscape, I would include Silvo. because it fits there. Also, I have to say that I also speak about this in the documentary. The way that it's used now is not like it was used like 40, 50 years ago. I mean, it's very rare to now hear silbo naturally in the outdoors in La Gomera. I mean, you can, but it's rarer than before. I mean, there's less people working with cattle. So yeah, for me, if I hear it naturally while recording, I would consider it natural and hence biophony. But I'm just throwing a rock there and see, okay, this is what I would think.
How are we able to frame the silvo and similar communication systems around the world as a testimony to human culture that develops alongside and it's also shaped by nature? You just gave a very good example with the cattle, which is not as common as before. And there is also the cell phone, which took over most people's daily lives.
Silvo is a good example of ecological adaptation for humans to a situation. Obviously, we are sometimes forgetting that we are part of nature. And for me, silvo was a perfect example of, hey, this is something that we developed to adapt to our surroundings, to the place we are living at. And obviously, there are a lot of other environmental filters or factors that have shaped how we humans exist and are today, like a full complex evolutionary history. Silvo is just an example. But the reason I chose silvo and whistle languages is because it felt like emotionally connects. We could think about other examples, morphology, or why we have fingers the way we have them and other structures. I mean, there's a lot of research on this. But one that it felt like allows us to connect was through our own communication, which is something that is very us, but also has been shaped by nature. When I was thinking about the origins of this project a couple of years ago already, I wanted to know how our communications fits in the rest of the other species singing, right? Like, okay, there's the acoustic niche hypothesis where every species tries to find its own space. And I think, okay, where do we fit in that situation? And actually I was thinking, okay, I need a place with a very mature and pristine ecosystems where we are still communicating. And I was thinking about communities in rainforests and trying to find tribes or indigenous people somewhere. And actually a friend of mine told me, do you remember silvo? And he's like, wow. Silvo is like, if you meet them, it's like a town in Spain. I mean, it doesn't feel that remote, or you're not going to the center of uncontacted tribe in the Amazon. I mean, it's just people. They speak in the same language that I do, and they wear the similar clothes that I do, and they still have this amazing trait. It has lasted for so many years. So it was also important to me to not do helicopter science. Do you know what helicopter science is?
No, actually, I've never heard of the term, I think.
For example, imagine, okay, I am from the rich Western country, and I say, okay, I have this funding, and I'm going to do research in Indonesia. And then I go there, and I extract all the information that I want. I do whatever I want, and then I forget about these people and do nothing. And you don't even collaborate with anyone from there, and just... So that's helicopter science. That could be translated also to other disciplines, not only science. For my documentary, I contacted people doing silvo and I tried to speak to understand them, and I gave them the documentary to use them the way they wanted. So it felt right. That's something just to be aware of, I think.
On the episode on this podcast with Sean Ronayne, he talked a lot about bird mimicry, and we heard some of his stories and listened to some examples. And in your film about the silvo, there's also an episode about the black bird, which I didn't know that they had a capacity for mimicry. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that blackbirds could imitate as well. I mean, I knew that they were great composers because they're trying to get inspired to improve their songs. So when the breeding season comes, they have something distinct so they can make themselves unique in the multitude of blackbirds. But while I was interviewing Kiko, he told me about this, like someone from his family was hearing his name in silvo, and it was not a person calling. It was the blackbird who picked up his name from a previous conversation. And it was an anecdote, and I was like, oh, fascinating. I hope I can listen to this. Then once I was checking my recordings from my automatic devices, and usually don't listen to everything, but I listen to small parts and see something. And I happened to know the word Lauri Silva in Silbo, which is the type of vegetation proper from La Gomera. And then there was this blackbird that it was doing, I think it's whistling. Is this a blackbird? Is this a person? And I think, I don't know how many times I listened to that small clip of audio. Like, I think I got this blackbird just whistling. I mean, despite of not being that present in the landscape now, it totally makes sense that tourist guides would go to the forest and trying to doing whistling examples to the people and saying, hey, I'm going to whistle Lauri Silva, Lauri Silva. So that's the word that the blackbirds pick up. And then also I started to check on other articles and early records of Silbo in the 50s in some articles. You could see that there were people calling Francisco or Maria de Los Angeles, who are typical Spanish names. And so, yeah, this is something that has been happening there in the island. There are words that are picked up by blackbirds.
This is really amazing, and it speaks a lot about animal culture. I think that a lot of people, and I definitely see myself in it, when the knowledge that we get from some books or mostly nature documentaries that we see mostly in our childhood, in which we get an idea about evolution of mammals like primates that use certain materials as tools, or with whales, there's also more like this predominance of this sort of evolution on mammals. But on birds, it's not something that came across, you know, all these years that I was watching these programs and even being interested in it. But I think maybe a lot of people tend to think about birds, you know, who are doing nests and courtship dances and raising the kids and, you know, picking seeds or worms for food. And there is so much more about it, and it's so fascinating.
It is amazing. And that culture is super unique. I mean, this leads me to just say, let me say this super quick. I also talk about this in the documentary. There was a wildfire in one area of the island in 2012. The vegetation is recovering and birds are coming back, so it's fantastic. But there is probably a whole population of birds with its own culture, taking up words from Silbo and other sources, that has been lost. And obviously, we will have new soundscapes, but, you know, keep the same sounds that before. This could be applied to any ecosystem. Like, once you lose it, even if new species go there and colonize, it will not sound the same.
Do you think there is a chance of some human language being like preserved in certain bird groups?
I guess that through time you will not have the same words. I mean, blackbirds do not know what they are saying, but it's right that you can see those traits in the communication of birds. So probably in another community, if it's not been super far away and it hasn't been many years, let's imagine that Silbo disappears. I'm guessing that for some time you will see traits of Silbo in the animal community. I don't know what would happen after that. I mean, probably something that could be studied somewhere. This is something that is discussed in the book from Tom Mastil about how to speak whale. You know, about the populations of whale have specific cultures. Cultures that we might not even be aware of. Once they are lost forever. I mean, because they evolve differently. And there's this moment in the book where they explain that only one whale of the pack was surviving. You think about the whole culture of that population of whales. It's only in that individual. So thinking about what animal cultures and things that we are not even aware of that we might be losing, being aware of that is like, wow. And we don't even fully understand it at this point. The reason I worked in La Gomera was because they have these Lauri Silva rainforests, which are very mature. Yeah, are unique. They are considered like a relict, like a type of forest that should not be there anymore because of the latitude. And also, Lauri Silva used to cover a big part of the Mediterranean area like millions of years ago. And now Lauri Silva is in the Mediterranean and in Europe is very scarce. I mean, you can see some small spots, some small areas. So it's often assumed that in Canary Islands, in particular in La Gomera, is one of the biggest areas of laurisilva that has lasted for many, many years. And that's why it is unique. It's there and then it should be there. Like it's been preserved by them, by the humidity and the winds. And there's been a series of conditions that have preserved that. But it's like a remnant from other times, we could think of that. And that's one of the reasons. I mean, it's unique. Just because of that, it should be preserved. It's a national park. I mean, it's amazing. But in terms of sounds, it's true that what I've seen in my work there is the more mature forest has a stronger and more active assembly mechanisms. Let me explain what I mean by assembly mechanisms. So you have this soundscape, you have the different sounds and animals singing and organizing there. So there are factors that organize this community singing. So what I've seen in studying and doing my statistics is that the type of processes that are behind this are stronger and are more robust in the more mature ecosystem. For example, niche partitioning. We were talking about this before, acoustic niche hypothesis, how species organize to have different frequencies and avoid overlap. So this process would be stronger in the more mature ecosystem, so they would differentiate better, as an example. Also, these forests, what I've seen is that they have a higher diversity. And in general, they're organized differently than transitional forests or secondary forests. But I don't want to generalize. I mean, I'm sure there are other situations and soundscapes are super, super complex. There are other factors that influence even meteorology, land use changes, if there are ecosystem mosaics, what is going on around it, and the extension of the area, how big or how small is the pristine area that you're working with. I mean, there are a number of factors that can be influencing it. So even if I say, okay, mature ecosystems have bigger and complex and amazing soundscapes than other places, I mean, depends. We could say that as a trend, but not all the time. But still, it's very important to preserve them. Because at least the animal communities that have lived there have had time to organize and arrange and become more complex. If you lose that, it would take a really long time to get that back. So it's a perfect place to understand how species organize, what they are doing. And some other places, secondary forests or more degraded ecosystems, you might not be able to study that.
So, in the context of such an ecosystem, how can we view a recovery and what does it mean to go back to normal after a fire, for example, the fire that happened in 2012?
After the fire, the plant community is regrowing and colonization is of animals is happening. What I can say is that could go back to not normal, but to something different, possibly. Depending also on climate change, obviously, the meteorology of the area. Every time is more warm, it's less humid, so obviously communities and ecosystems will be a little bit different. Wildfires are just another part of the ecosystem. It has been happening naturally for always. Perhaps now we are experiencing different trends of mega fires or extreme fire events and different intensities. So that obviously put people in danger and it has implications. But the fact is that the wildfires can be good for the general area. There are open areas that are very good for some birds, for example, that cannot thrive in dense forests. I mean, the existence of fire, it has to be, it's part of it. But perhaps what I would say is that now we have to think, where do we want those fires to occur? Perhaps in La Gomera, it's super different. It's not that big. Fire there is very destructive because of the type of community that you have. Obviously, something is going to grow and you will have a new community or a new ecosystem, but then you have your position of, okay, do I want to preserve that or do I want to just leave it as it is and see what happens in many years. It totally depends. I'm not a super specialist in wildfires either, but it has positive effects sometimes, and some other times you want to preserve what you can have. What I can say is that through sound, through field recording, and through soundscapes, we can hear how is the ecosystem changing and where are you going. So I think it's beautiful because you don't just see the recovery of the area or the degradation of the area, but you can actually hear, okay, who's coming back here? What is growing? What is the type of community that is being formed after a wildfire? And that's super interesting.
So it's time for that question. As a field recordist, are you comfortable being out in the darkness?
Personally, yes. But also because I am lucky and there are not dangerous animals in the places where I usually live, where I've been there at night. If I know that there is a wolf pack around it, maybe I would not want to be there at night unless I am super protected, because recording those would be amazing. But I feel comfortable. Yeah, I don't have like a panic or afraid of the dark while I'm in nature in general. But if I know that there might be dangerous animals, then I might consider moving. I have to say that if I do this, I prefer to go when there is a full moon or, you know, there is not cloudy. So you have a little bit of that. So full dark without a light in your front or something like that. Maybe not that comfortable.
Even if we are a little bit scared of being out in the darkness, especially if we are alone, which is kind of an extra level, I really find that the sensorial perception that seemingly shifts, it's one of the best sensations in the world. It's really exciting.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, you have to actually put effort to hear, and it forces you to be very, very present.
What is your favorite type of field recordings or natural soundscapes?
So I have to say that I connect a lot with my own field recordings. The ones that I liked more are from storms. It's amazing when you record a thunder. That's something that's quite amazing, and I can get lost there recording. A small geophone is like a crack of the wood. Something small that is like, what is exactly coming? That's something that's small that you want to actually hear, because obviously with a microphone you can amplify sounds that otherwise you would not hear, and then you're listening to those. That's quite fantastic. I'm going to say as well, we're discussing this, but Silvo, the first time that I heard it live through the microphone and through my headphones, the way that it transmitted through the landscape and the reverberation of the mountain, that was amazing. That was quite a moment. And from others, I'm going to say that I have been exploring a little bit whale sounds recently. A whole different world. Roger Payne, for example, yeah.
Very interesting, because I think the last three people I spoke to about this, they precisely mention this work from Roger Payne.
I think one of the reasons why people might be bringing this up is because of the book How to Speak Whale from Tom Mustill. I was actually reading this very recently, so maybe that's why the reference is quite live. I think the book that is also a classic, possibly, is The Great Animal Orchestra from Bernie Krause. So something that really, really inspired me back then. And records that inspire me, okay, I have to confess that I listen to more music than to soundscapes normally in my daily life. So I'm going to say two records that no one is going to say, but that I love them from many, many years ago. And one is called Stura from a band called Jangres from the north of Spain. That's Celtic music. It's mostly instrumental and I always found it super special. But the weirdest record that I'm going to probably say is from the 80s, is the 1980, and it's called Batiscafo from Gregorio Paniagua. It was ahead of his time. Both are on Spotify. The fun thing about the second record that I'm saying is that he uses small anthropophonies like phones ringing and things clashing. Everything is incorporated into music. So I always find it super interesting.
You just listened to Rudiger Ortiz Alvarez on The Wind is the Original Radio podcast. In the episode's notes, we provide all links so you can learn more about Rudiger and his work, as well as watch his documentary Ecotone. Earth FM is a non-profit repository of hundreds of immersive soundscapes from around the world, recorded by the best artists. If you resonate with our mission, please consider supporting us by becoming a member or donating on www.earth.fm. Join us in the effort of awakening together to the wonders and preciousness of Mother Earth.